Welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Bart Lombardo, and you'll be answering your questions on Passionate About Panfish. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Bart a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use that Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill out the form on the right side of our homepage, and we'll let you know when the next live show will be. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website about 48 hours after the show ends. You can also find it on any of the podcast sites like Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website or any of the podcast platforms at your convenience and listen to the recording at any time. If you're out and about on Facebook, Instagram, or X, we'd sure appreciate it if you'd share our podcast. And when you do, use the hashtag AskAboutFlyFishing and hashtag FlyFishing. In fact, if you have a moment, do it while you're watching the show. We'd really appreciate it. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. When we return, we'll be talking with Bart Lombardo about Passionate About Panfish. Watermaster is dedicated to providing their customers with the highest quality inflatables on the market, as well as unbeatable customer service and product support. They are best known for their signature products, the Watermaster Grizzly, Kodiak, and Bruin rafts. These rafts are lightweight, compact, durable, versatile, and safe. The Watermaster rafts are everything your personal watercraft should be. They have been used by anglers and hunters all over the world. Visit Watermaster today and take a look at the ultimate personal flotation craft. Go to BigSkyInflatables.com. Again, that's BigSkyInflatables.com. Before we introduce Bart, I'd like to let you know about the great prizes we have to give away tonight. For our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to Fly Fishers International and a one-year membership to Trout Unlimited. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage at AskAboutFlyFishing.com and look for the link under tonight's section that says Register for our free drawing. Click on that link and fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a selection of Bart's favorite panfish flies, courtesy of Bart and his business, Panfish on the Fly. If you'd like to learn more about panfish on the fly, just go to that URL, panfishonthefly.com. So here's how you can win. You must be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. The question will be about something we talked about during the show, and you must submit your answer along with your name and your location using that text box on our homepage. So listen closely. Take notes, and hopefully you'll win Bart's selection of his favorite panfish flies. Our guest tonight is Bart Lombardo. Bart's love for fly fishing and fly tying spans almost five decades. His pursuit of trout and salmon takes him across the country, but his heart lies in the thrill of fly fishing for panfish, bass, and other warm water species. Bart enjoys teaching others about fly fishing and the art of fly tying. He is a fly fishing guide for South Branch Outfitters in Califon, New Jersey, and on the staff as a fly fishing and fly tying instructor for Orvis in Princeton, New Jersey. He regularly conducts fly tying classes and presentations for fly fishing clubs and organizations like Trout Unlimited, and participates in various fly tying shows on the East Coast. Bart is a respected figure in the fly tying industry, constantly pushing the boundaries of his craft. His innovative patterns for panfish, bass, and other warm water species are a testament to his creativity. As a member of several pro staffs, including Regal Vice, Semperfly, Solarace, Flyman Fly Fishing, and E-Wing Tackle, he has earned recognition for his contributions. Bart is also an outdoor writer whose work appears in print and online. He has written several articles published in Fly Fishing Magazine and is currently writing a book called Panfish on the Fly, The Definitive Guide to Fly Fishing for America's Favorite Fish, which will be released by Imbrex Books in 2016. Bart, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Thank you. Thank you, Roger. I'm looking forward to it. I've been a big fan of the show for a long time.
Oh, good, good. Yeah, that's nice to hear. Nice to have fans on the show. that works out great. Yeah, yeah. So you know how it rolls. So we have lots of questions to answer. Yeah, lots of questions to answer. And let's just dive right in. You know, what sparked your passion for fly fishing, in particular for panfish, like sunfish and bluegill, crappie, and so forth?
Yeah, and I think that's where it all started for me as far as fly fishing was concerned. You know, as a young man, as a kid growing up, I read a lot about fly fishing in the outdoor magazines, but growing up as an inner city kid in New Jersey, there wasn't a lot of fly fishing opportunities, you know, in my general neighborhood. So my only experience was reading about it in books and magazines. And when I was a teenager, my parents moved from the city to a more suburban area that had access to, you know, a lot of local smaller waters, farm ponds and neighborhood ponds, park ponds. And that's what really kicked off my interest in fishing. And that's really where I first observed fly fishing for the first time. I had always assumed that the only fly fish for more glamorous fish like trout and salmon. But one day I observed a gentleman who was probably about as old as I am now. He was an older guy, probably late 50s, early 60s. And I saw him out there fly fishing for bluegill. And I watched him take fish after fish after fish. And I was hooked after that. It was something that I had to try on my own. And try I did. And I guess I worked out all my kinks in fly fishing, practicing on fish like, you know, bluegills and largemouth bass, which generally I think a lot of folks would agree that they're probably a little bit easier than trout and moving water. But that's where it all started. Then, of course, you know, I ultimately went on to, you know, pursue those more glamorous fish like trout and salmon and saltwater species. It all started with panfish.
That's similar. Well, similar for me with fly fishing was a farmer's pond that was just a couple of blocks from our house here in Colorado, and my friend and I fished for largemouth bass and panfish on the fly. And that's I fished before that, you know, in Alaska and stuff, but it was never fly fishing, so that was my first experience too on the flies. Like you say, a little easier than many of the other ones we pursue nowadays, but it gets you hooked, as you said. It gets you hooked.
Yes, it
Yeah,
does.
can you share a particularly memorable experience that deepened your appreciation for panfish?
Well, you know, I think it goes right back to that very first experience when I saw that gentleman out there on that, you know, on that bluegill pond casting a fly rod. I had never really, even as a teenager, I was anxious to start fly fishing and anxious to get into it. Was, you know, always thought I had to wait until I had access to water that trout swam in. And when I saw that gentleman fly fishing for panfish, for warm water fish, a light bulb just went off that I don't have to wait to fish for trout, that I could, you know, fly fish for these fish that were close to home.
You know, and that's changed so much over the past, you know, 50 years or so. You know, people used to look down on fishing for carp on the fly, right? I mean, or for fishing carp for any reason,
Exactly,
you know? And now it's like, whoa, that's kind of like this exotic fish you can fish for on the fly, you know? It's nowadays, I think anything goes, right? Anything. I've seen people catching catfish on the fly and, you know, all kinds of things. So, for sure, panfish. What
and there.
species fall? Go ahead.
No, and it's, you know, one of these things. There's still this stigmatism with fly fishing with a lot of folks that it's all about trout and salmon and exotic saltwater species. I can't count the number of times that I was fly fishing on a warm water pond, either next to a road or in an area, maybe a park where there's people walking around, and I have folks come up to me and ask, you know, if there's trout swimming in this pond, because there has to be trout if I'm fly fishing. And there's still a lot of people out there are surprised that we could fly fish for other things besides trout.
Birds, things like that. Just saying from experience, I happened to hook a frigate berg in Belize one time, not intentionally, but he was flying rather low over the boat. Anyway, what species fall under the heading of panfish for you?
Well, I'll tell you what it is for me, and it may vary from person to person, but, you know, first off, it's members of the sunfish family. Now, the sunfish family also includes larger fish like the black bass, largemouth bass, smallmouth bass. A lot of folks may not realize that they are actually in the same family as bluegills and redbreast and long-eared sunfish, but those true sunfish, You know, your bluegills, your red ears, your red breasts, your long ears, you know, those are obviously, I think, what most people would consider panfish, as well as their other sunfish cousins like warmouth, rock bass, crappie, all, again, all members of the sunfish family, and all fish that I would classify as panfish. But there's fish that fall outside of that sunfish family, fish like yellow perch, white perch. I'll even throw, you know, white bass and yellow bass into that category. These are all smaller freshwater fish that I think could all be considered panfish.
Okay, okay. Are some of those more challenging than others to fly fish for?
You know what? I think so. There are, when we're fishing in the, you know, the height of spring, when the fish are all shallow, when they're spawning, the fishing is about as easy as it can get. But once we get outside of that spring season, all of these fish can provide some unique angling challenges because they're no longer pushovers. They're no longer, you know, swimming over one another to get at your fly. So seasonal changes could make even the easiest fish to catch a little bit more difficult. So that certainly comes into play. But I think there are fish, you know, fish like red ear sunfish, which are predominantly bottom feeders. They do most of their feeding on or near the bottom. It could be challenging to present flies to them in a way that they find attractive. And I think just in speaking with folks over the years, I think crappie give people a lot of headaches at times as well. So, you know, there are some species in there that can be a little bit more challenging than others, but I think seasonal changes could really affect the fishing for all different species of fish that I consider panfish.
Yeah, I know there's, we've got some questions people sent in about crappie particularly. So yeah, they seem to be running up against some challenges. I remember catching crappie as a kid up in Wisconsin with my grandfather, but more recently, 25 years ago, I was working down in, you know, Missouri and Arkansas and stuff, and ran into some guys that were crappie fishermen, and it was like their thing. And they had boats with, not fly fishing, but they had boats with like four or five rods in rigs on the front of the boat, and they'd move that boat around the water, you know, with four lines, five lines in the water. It was like a spider on the front of the boat moving around.
And right.
I don't know. I'd never heard of that before or seen it, but I thought that was pretty interesting as far as fishing for crappie goes anyway. But, yeah.
Yeah, they're an interesting fish.
What the seasonal changes, you had just mentioned that, you know, they affect their feeding habits and, you know, where they might be in the water and so forth. Do they, all these fish that you've just talked about, are they all spring spawners? So is that, I mean, is there just a lot of activity going on in the spring with all of them?
Yeah, they are all spring spawners. Some of the fish, and a lot of members of the sunfish family, they actually have the potential and often spawn more than once in a given season. You know, a bluegill can spawn multiple times throughout the year, and it's one of the reasons why they're so prolific. But generally speaking, things really start to heat up in the spring when the water temps rise. And again, different fish species, they prefer different spawning temperatures. I think fish like yellow perch are probably the earliest spawners out of this collective group of fish I call panfish. And they'd be followed by crappie, white and black crappie. They tend to spawn in a little cooler water temperature than the rest of the sunfish. And then once we get up into water temps 65 to 70 degrees, I think most of the sunfish and bass species are spawning at that point. So that kind of temperature band of, say, you know, 60 to 70 degrees, you're going to find a lot of things going on, you know, warm water bodies, you know, bodies of water that are effectively, you know, warm water fisheries. That is the heyday of the year. That's when you want to be out on the water. That's when these fish get the reputation of being pushovers, or, you know, when they're on their spawning beds, you can catch them on a bare hook practically. So they're not very difficult to catch during that time. And there's a very big portion of anglers that's the only time that they chase these fish. And they kind of get a reputation of being very, very easy to catch, which they are at that time of year. But as the seasons change, the fish behavior changes, and they can be a little bit more challenging to catch. So, you know, one of the great things about fly fishing for panfish is we can catch a lot of them while we're out. you know, a good day on a trout stream is maybe four or five fish, and you walk away from the river feeling like you accomplished something. And, you know, you can 10 times that number and experience that on a daily basis when you're fly fishing for these fish during the spring. But if you're looking for a challenge, continue to target them during the dog days of summer and the changing weather of fall, or even in the pre-spawn or during the cold months of winter. They can provide that challenge that you're seeking if you're looking for a challenge.
Yeah, and I know, the sunfish, panfish range everywhere from Florida up to Canada, don't they? I mean, as far as their geographic range?
They do. They are found, you know, just about every state with the exception of Alaska, and that may not be for too long. I think Alaska just, I think the first they recorded a catch of a largemouth bass in Alaska recently. So
bluegills
can't be far. if there's a bass swimming in Alaska, bluegills can't be far behind. But no, they are found throughout the country, which is another thing that makes them such an attractive fish, because we don't have to travel long distances to find them. There's a lot more of this country without trout than with trout. So, you know, a lot of anglers, they never seem to progress in their fishing expertise because they only fly fish a week or two a year when they make a trip out west or to some other trout destination. But these guys are, for most of us, they're just minutes away from our front door.
Yeah, probably in any public park that has a pond or a lake, they're probably there. And yeah, you don't see a lot of people fishing for them, but they could be. So, you know, we've talked about what other types of bodies of water do panfish prefer? I mean, is it generally ponds or lakes, or are they also in streams, rivers?
Yeah, that's the cool thing about these fish is they are literally found everywhere. Most people, you know, they associate these fish with, you know, smaller bodies of water, ponds and lakes, park ponds, farm ponds, small natural lakes. But they're also found in large man-made impoundments. And almost all of these fish are also found in moving water. Now, generally, they don't prefer the swift currents that trout do. But in slower moving, more temperate, you know, warm water streams, cool water streams, they're panfish everywhere. And now there's some species, like here in New Jersey, all of our trout streams have good populations of redbreast sunfish. And you may find similar sunfish in the lower sections of many trout rivers throughout the country. Maybe they're not redbreast. If we're out in the middle of the United States, maybe it's a species like a long-ear sunfish. But there are some sunfish, members of the sunfish family, fish that I consider panfish, like white bass, for example, that can be found in moving water and may actually prefer it. So it's not just ponds and lakes. It could be large man-made reservoirs and impoundments. It could be small, tiny creeks to large rivers. They even are found in some saltwater estuaries. They can tolerate a degree of salinity in the water, and there's a lot of tidal rivers and, you know, freshwater, saltwater mixed estuaries that have good populations of panfish. So they're literally found everywhere.
Wow, I didn't know that. Yeah, that's really interesting. Yeah. I know when I was a kid and fished in Wisconsin and the river, you know, there was pike, largemouth bass, smallmouth bass, and of course panfish as well. But it was, you know, it was kind of a slow moving river. There was one point where there was a little rapid, but that was it. Yeah, it was kind of like a slow moving lake kind of. But yeah, I guess where all those types of fish live, you know, there's room for panfish as well. Let's see. It's Phil McCartney. He's a longtime listener. He wrote in, he says, online here, he says, I imagine that many anglers think they know all there is to know about sunfish, and they are wrong. Please shock me with a little known fact about sunfish. Well, you just gave them one, right?
They're a very interesting fish, and, you know, for... You know, one thing that a lot of folks don't realize is, you know, I know that we, you know, a lot of folks often have questions about large fish and why, if there's, how to find waters that have bigger panfish, bigger sunfish. And, you know, I think these bigger fish, they can occur nearly anywhere. But, you know, everything at some point, anything that swims, crawls, or flies near, you know, any kind of warm water fishery, at some point, you know, a immature sunfish at some stage in its development is on the menu. Everything wants to eat these fish. They're basically a prey species, and they are fed upon everything from insects to mammals and birds, of course, to other fish. And, you know, for these fish to get large, the big fish have to do something a little bit different than everybody else. So sometimes just changing our tactics, changing our flies, we can get those larger fish a little bit more interested. And except in waters where there's a lot of stunting, those big fish could be just about anywhere.
Yeah, we'll talk more about that later, I hope so. Yeah, before we're going to take a break here, I want to answer a couple questions online here. Wayne, it says you have no link for tonight's program. Where's the website link? You're probably on it. AskAboutFlyFishing.com. AskAboutFlyFishing.com. If you were able to send these questions in, you should be right there and listening to the show. There is no other link. That's it. So hopefully that helps Wayne out. And let's see, Edward, where can I register on the page? The right-hand side column, there's a place where you can register to receive announcements. And down below, it says register for the free drawing. If that's what you're trying to do, then that's where you go for that. Okay, well, let's take a quick break here. And when we come back, we'll talk with Bart Moore about panfish on the fly. The Ugly Bug Fly Shop in Casper, Wyoming, has been serving fly fishers in Wyoming and around the world since 1983. Their selection of top-of-the-line gear and a huge assortment of flies is one of the best in the land. All products are available in their fly shop and online. Looking for advice? Just give them a call, and their expert professional staff will help you with whatever you need. Visit the Ugly Bug Fly Shop today at uglybugflyshop.com or call them at 866-845-9284. Again, it's uglybugflyshop.com. Call them at 866-845-9284. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Bart Lombardo about panfish on the fly. Now, if you'd like to ask Bart a question, just go to our homepage at AskAboutFlyFishing.com and use that Q&A text box to send us your question. Bart, I always ask my guests at this point in the show, you know, what's going on in your fly fishing world? So tell us about your business and the other things you do in relation to fly fishing.
Okay. Well, I do have a little side business called Panfish on the Fly. And Panfish on the Fly was started back in 2016. And the whole reason for the starting of that business is a couple years prior to that, I started guiding as a second career. I retired from a 30-year law enforcement career about 10 years ago. And right around the time I retired, just before I retired, I started guiding for a fly shop here in New Jersey. That was called Shannon's Fly and Tackle. And I guided for Shannon's for about 10 years. And early on in my guiding career, if you would, I discovered that getting a person who has never fly fished before and taking them out onto a trap stream and trying to have them present flies to fish that are very accustomed to feeding in a particular way, and you know they want their food presented to them in a very particular fashion, otherwise they just would not eat, and trying to get an angler who has never held a fly rod before into fish, it became very quickly that this was a pretty daunting challenge. And I kind of went back to my roots as a, you know, how I started in fly fishing, and, you know, quickly realized that if I can get that person who's never fly fished before and have them spend 4 or 5 hours with me on a local bass pond, and we'd fly fish for bluegills and fish like largemouth bass, that their chances of success would go up tenfold when I got them on the trout stream, because I could almost guarantee success taking a new angler out to fly fish for panfish, where trout sometimes presented quite a challenge, especially to an angler that may not be the best caster, line handler, etc. You make a sloppy cast on a trout stream and you put every fish in the pool down for 20 minutes. You make a sloppy cast on a bluegill pond and it's like you just rang the dinner bell. Everybody's looking up, want to know what made the noise. So they're a much more forgiving fish. And that's what prompted me to start Panfish on the Fly. And once I started it, I was amazed at how many closet panfish enthusiasts there are out there. It was like every fly fisher's dirty little secret that they love to go out and fly fish for panfish. So that it became quite popular. You know, I started a group on Facebook that addressed that very topic. It's called Panfish on the Fly. And I think currently we're just under 60,000 members. So there are a lot of folks out there who have a lot of interest in fly fishing for panfish. I still guide. The fly shop that I guide for now is called South Branch Outfitters. And they are, it is the original Shannon's Fly Shop. Jim Holland, the owner of the shop, passed away a couple of years ago. And so new folks stepped in to take over the shop. And Abraham and Lindsay, who are running the shop right now, they're doing a fantastic job. And I'm still guiding with them. I do I thoroughly enjoy getting folks started in fly fishing. So I do a lot of teaching, and I do a lot of that teaching through Orvis in Princeton. Orvis, as a company, runs a lot of fly fishing and fly tying classes that are free and open to the public. And I've been with Orvis now, I think, 6 years, and have been doing, you know, helping out and running a lot of their courses and classes at their Princeton, New Jersey location. Throughout this journey of guiding and, you know, developing the website Panfish and the Fly, I got into writing, and I've written a couple articles for Fly Fisherman magazine. I've done a bunch of stuff online, and a couple years ago I started on a book project. I was approached by a publisher to, you know, write a guide to fly fishing for panfish, and I did write that book. I finished that book. Unfortunately, about 2 weeks ago, I was informed by my publisher that they were dropping the project. So I have a finished book, fully edited, that, you know, I'm going to be looking for another publisher, and if not, I'll self-publish. But at the moment, the title of the book is Panfish on Fly, The Definitive Guide to Fly Fishing for America's Favorite Fish. And, you know, hopefully we'll see that in print soon.
Yeah, I'm sure we will. I'm sure there's plenty of other publishers out there that are ready to
It is it's a finished product. So
I'm ready to go.
Very confident that we'll get a take on that. And I do a lot of demonstration fly tying at the fly fishing and fly tying shows in the area. I basically do all the shows, all the fly fishing shows here on the East Coast. And this year I'll be traveling out to the Midwest fly fishing show in Detroit, so starting to expand my range with that a little bit as well.
Nice. It's always great to give back like that. Okay, yeah, we got a few more questions coming in online. Let's get back to our questions here. David Goff in Colorado had asked about what temperature when the panfish come alive, and I think you already answered that. It was 60 to 70 degrees in the spring, but he's also asking, what are the temperature ranges that you prefer for topwater dries and nymphs? Is there different, you know, temperatures for fishing those types of flies?
You know, generally, that temperature range at 60 to 70 degrees, that is going to be game on time for topwater. But I do enjoy some quality topwater fishing at other times of the years when, you know, the water may not be optimal, both in the high range as well as the low range. We haven't really talked about fishing through the seasons, and I'm sure those questions will come up. But I've enjoyed some really good topwater midge fishing for sunfish as early as, like, just after ice out, if the weather conditions are appropriate. So they will eat on the surface in cooler temperatures, but generally speaking, I think for sunfish, that 60 to 70 degree range, even a little warmer, is going to produce a lot of good topwater action. But other fish may feed a little bit early. Like, most folks don't associate crappie with topwater feeding, but I do find that they, especially on cloudy days, low light days, they feed pretty regularly on the surface, and that may occur in water temperatures a little bit cooler than that 60 to 70 degrees.
Let's talk about equipment a little bit here. We've got Jeff in Indiana, Gary in North Carolina, talking about what rods and line weight you use. Also, Bob Younger wrote in online here, and also Pat in New York. So all kinds of people wanting to know about gear. So let's start with the weight of the fly rod and line that you use. And also,
sure.
Scott was talking about, you know, the different types of lines, floating, intermediate, sinking. And I know you have a lot to say about this, so I'll let you roll.
All right. So, yeah, I definitely have an ideal panfish rod in mind. And for me, that's a, you know, 7.5 to 8.5 foot full flex or mid flex four weight. And why a four weight? 2 and 3 weights are great. I fish a lot of them when the conditions are right for it. But there's a few advantages that I think that a four weight gives me over these lighter rods. First of all, four weight is still light enough to appreciate these scrappy little fish. I mean, they are hard fighting fish. If they grew to 5 pounds on a regular basis, I don't think anybody would fish for anything else. So that four weight is still a light enough rod for me to appreciate the fight of these fish, but it allows me to do some things that 2 and 3 weights can't. First of all, if I'm fishing on windy days, that little heavier line, little heavier rod is going to perform a little bit different, cast a little bit better than a 2 or 3 weight. But I also have a tendency to fish a lot of double fly rigs, popper dropper rigs, maybe a team of wet flies, you know, a hopper dropper type setup. And fishing those double fly rigs on 2s and 3 weights, which a lot of anglers love to use for these smaller fish, casting those kind of rigs, they could be problematic. They could be a little bit difficult. And also I have a tendency to fish flies that are probably a little bit larger than some folks would fish. And that four weight helps me deliver those flies a little easier. Why a full flex rod versus a fast action rod? A fast action rod certainly has its place, but my pan fishing tends to be a little bit more relaxed, a little bit slower. I tend to slow down a little bit and really enjoy the casting. And I love the way a slower rod performs or feels in my hands when I'm casting. And I also think it helps me open up my loops and cast those more cumbersome flies, those double fly rigs, a little bit easier. But I do fish 2s and 3 weights, you know, when the conditions are right, and I often have to go heavier. If I'm fishing an intermediate or a sinking line, it's very difficult to find those lines in anything lighter than a 5 weight. So I may have to go to a 5 or even a 6 weight when fishing those types of lines. I recently collaborated with a fly rod manufacturer, J.P. Ross. They're located out here in New York, here on the East Coast. And Jordan from J.P. Ross Rods and I, we got together last winter at a fly fishing show up in Massachusetts. And we put our heads together and kind of came up with what I feel is the perfect fly rod for panfish. I mean, if anyone's interested in checking out that fly rod, you can head over to J.P. Ross and head over to their website and look up the Panfish on the Fly rod, or you can come over to Panfish on the Fly. I have some information about it there. And basically what the Panfish and Fly Edition rod is, it is a S-glass 7.5 foot four weight. I do love glass rods for that slower feel that I mentioned earlier. But what makes this rod unique is that the rod was built with a stiffer than normal butt section, so that I still can appreciate the fight of a smaller fish due to that softer, more flexible fiberglass. But that stiffer butt section allows me to really, if I need to push that rod in windy conditions or push that cast to deliver a big bulky deer hair bug or maybe a two fly rig, the rod allows me to do it with ease. And another benefit to that is, which I haven't discussed yet, is often when we're fly fishing for panfish, we have a lot of chance encounters with larger predators. Now, depending on where you're fishing, those fish may be largemouth bass or smallmouth bass, chain pickerel, even larger fish like northern pike. And every year I catch 5 to 6 pound largemouth bass on panfish flies. And trying to land a bass of that size on a two weight is quite a challenge. I have found that, you know, on these four-weight rods, particularly this new rod that I've been fishing from J.P. Ross with that stiffer butt section, I could really lay into that rod and apply a lot of pressure on these larger fish. So that's another reason why I prefer maybe a slightly heavier rod than most anglers would grab when going after these smaller fish.
Yeah,
and I think
sense.
You also had a question about, question about lines.
Right. Scott Gates,
I can touch base on that real
lines.
Quick here.
Yeah,
let me touch base on that real quick. I do the vast majority of my fishing with, you know, your standard weight forward floating fly line. You can get a lot done in a warm water environment with that line. However, there are times that, you know, we need to get below the surface. Typically, that occurs when the water's a little bit cooler and those fish aren't up in the shallows. Or maybe it's in the middle of the summer, you know, during those dog days of summer when the water temperatures in the shallows are elevated to the point where it's uncomfortable for even warm water fish, and those fish retreat to deeper water, then, you know, intermediate lines, sink tip lines, and sometimes even these parabolic full sinking lines come into play if you really want to get technical and chase these fish during the off seasons. But by and large, you can do just fine with your standard weight forward fly line.
Okay. Pat Ringers in Wisconsin is asking about leaders. He ties his own leaders. Do you do anything special with leaders, or is it a simple, straightforward approach?
Yeah, you can get pretty simple with these fish. They're generally not leader shy. There are some conditions in which you may have to get long and fine for them, but generally speaking, they're not leader shy. So typically, I try and match my leader length to my rod. So if I'm fishing a 7.5-foot rod, then a 7.5-foot leader and, you know, 3 or 4X is usually all you need. That being said, I do have a custom-tied leader that I tie when I'm fishing larger flies, like poppers or more air-resistant deer hair bugs. And the leader's built with a little bit stiffer butt section and a heavier tippet section to help turn over those larger flies. But that's really about the only time that I'll look to use any kind of specialty leader.
Okay.
Most of the time, leaders aren't much of a concern. There's even times where I'm just running straight mono or straight fluorocarbon, especially when fishing subsurface.
Yeah, that's what I kind of figured. Yeah. Time to take another break, Bart, but hang with me. We'll be right back and talk more about fishing for panfish. Discover the power of pure Skagit with Olympic Peninsula Skagit Tactics. From delicate, soft tackles to hefty steelhead flies, OPST's versatile casting system meets the demands of every angling situation. With Ed Ward's unparalleled Skagit rod design and casting expertise, OPST offers you a quicker route to mastering effective casting techniques. Whether battling wind and rain or targeting steelhead, trout, or smallmouth bass, trust OPST's innovative rods, lines, and tips to elevate your fishing experience. Join the ranks of skilled anglers who rely on OPST for consistency, proficiency, and a superior fly fishing adventure. Unleash your potential with OPST today. Visit pureskagit.com or call them at 206-858-8476. Again, it's pureskagit.com, or you can call them at 206-858-8476. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Bart Lombardo about being passionate about panfish. If you'd like to ask Bart a question, go to our homepage and askaboutflyfishing.com and fill out that Q&A text box and send us your question, and we'll try to answer it on the show tonight. Okay, talking about flies now, and you've mentioned this a couple of times, so I'm just going to start out with talking about the size of flies, because in my mind, I'm thinking, okay, sunfish, panfish, you know, bluegills, crappie don't have terribly big mouths. Well, maybe the bigger ones do, but the ones that I remember don't. And yet the largemouth bass has a huge mouth. So do you kind of determine what fish are going after by the size of the flies? Or are sunfish trying to take in more than maybe they should?
Well, that's a great question, and, you know, we could really geek out about flies and fly patterns, but in general, when you think about a warm water fishery and the type of food that's available to these fish, there is far more aquatic life and terrestrial life, as far as that goes, that's available to warm water fish than there are, say, trout. You know, trout, you have your you know, your stoneflies, your mayflies, your caddisflies, your midges, you know, maybe some minnow life in the river, some terrestrial insects, and that's about it. When we get into the warm water scenario, in a lot of cases, with maybe the exception of stoneflies, we'll see all of those same insects in a lot of these warm water environments, plus dragonflies and damselflies and freshwater shrimp and scuds and terrestrial insects of all sorts, not to mention, you know, numerous baitfish species, juvenile fish species. These fish eat basically anything, and that's what's so cool about tying flies for these fish is, you know, there's two approaches. We can match, you know, kind of match the hatch, so to speak, and have our flies mimic natural organisms, or you can go totally off the reservation and throw some really odd stuff to these fish, and they'll still react positive to it. You know, one of my most popular flies that I developed over the years is a fly called the triangle bug. And what the triangle bug is just basically a, you know, it's a floating fly made of foam. It's in the shape of a triangle with a short calf tail or synthetic fiber or marabou tail. And it's floating triangle. It doesn't look like anything that a fish would eat. And the sole reason for this fly existing was the fact that you mentioned at the beginning of the question that sunfish in particular have very small mouths, but they have this tendency and this reputation to take flies that are far bigger than what you think they could actually eat. And when they do take these flies, they take them very deeply, which makes unhooking them hazardous to the fish. It's not a problem if you're keeping them for the table, but if you're practicing catch and release, you can injure or kill a lot of fish that are hooked deeply. So the triangle bug was simply designed to stop fish from swallowing the fly. The narrow end of the triangle that is easy for them to grab off the surface of the water, but the broad leading edge of the fly presents, you know, it prevents them from swallowing it. And I've been tying this fly for decades now, and it's starting to get a little nationwide notoriety, and folks are talking about it. And I love hearing all these explanations about what the fly is supposed to imitate. And I hear all these claims, it's a moth, it's a frog, it's this, it's that. The truth of the matter is it doesn't imitate anything. It's a floating triangle that they can't swallow. But that's one of the things that are so cool about these fish is they will eat such a wide variety of patterns. So to try and get this question back on track, what are some of the flies that I like to fish or sizes of flies? If you fish smaller flies, you're definitely going to catch more fish, and you're going to catch more smaller fish. But when I'm fly fishing for panfish, I'm predominantly interested in the larger specimens. I'm hunting those trophy fish. And so I fish larger flies. I fish a lot of flies in a size 6, size 8, which most people would consider to be on the large size for a, you know, smallmouth bluegill or some other sunfish. But a good size, 8, 9, 10-inch sunfish, foot-long sunfish, has no problem eating anything big as a size 6. In fact, those larger fish, I've caught them on flies, you know, intended for bass, size 2, size 4. I've caught some very big sunfish on bass flies. And another benefit to fishing those slightly larger flies is that you do have a tendency to attract more attention from these larger predator fish, which always makes the day a little bit more exciting. You know, when you intend to go out and just catch a dozen bluegills on the surface after dinner and you manage to hook a 3 or 4 pound largemouth bass while you're out there fly fishing for panfish. So that's another reason why I tend to go towards larger flies, because I have, you know, more encounters with those predator fish. But I fish everything. Basically, if you're a trout angler and you want to get into this, any fly in your trout boxes are going to work for panfish. And, you know, for many years before I started tying flies specifically for panfish, I had a coffee mug on my fly tying desk that I called the bluegill cup. Any fly that I tied that wasn't up to par for my local brown trout got thrown in that cup for panfish. You know, if I was first, I can remember when I was trying to, I was learning how to tie a Royal Coachman, and was trying to get that floss body right and getting the peacock curl and the upright goose wings perfect. And it took a lot of attempts to perfect that fly. And I think I filled up that bluegill mug almost halfway up with all these Royal Coachmen
Royal
rejects
Coachman,
before I finally, and the panfish love them. So that's the great thing about them. They, you know, just like they don't care about your ugly cast, they don't care about your ugly flies either. They're a little bit more forgiving in the fly department. So you can fish just about anything for them, from wet flies to dry flies to foam bugs and poppers. I even fish a lot of streamer patterns for them.
Yeah, you answered, I think, a lot of the questions that were coming in there. Jason was asking about your go-to fly for panfish. I'm taking that as the triangle bug as the, your go-to
well,
fly.
Well, it is a fly that I fish a lot, but I probably, if I had a lockdown one fly, that if I had a, if I only had a choice of one fly, I would probably pick just a very simple, generic wet fly, something like a soft tackle. These flies are absolutely deadly on panfish, and a lot of folks don't consider using them. But yeah, simple wet flies and soft tackles, I find them to be some of the most effective flies out there.
Yeah, well, they have a lot of movement, right, under the water.
Exactly. And,
pulse,
and they're
pulsating.
And they're in the water where, and they can imitate such a wide variety of natural food items that these fish feed on, from, insect life to small fish. They do it all. In a pinch, you can dry them off, grease them, and fish them in the film as well. So a very, very versatile pattern. I fish a lot of flies, a lot of soft tackle.
Jim Wright in Thornton, Colorado, wrote in and said, what is your favorite searching fly pattern for locating crappie in new waters? Is there anything in particular you use for crappie?
Yeah, and that these fish are predominantly minnow feeders. They do eat some insect life and some other things, but they really focus in on other smaller fish. So a small streamer, and by small, I mean an inch and a half, 2 inches long, I think is a great searching pattern for these fish. And there's a couple trains of thought with this, too. I mean, these are, most of these sunfish in general are often attracted to some pretty garish colors. So you can go with a bright attractor-style fly or something that looks a little bit more natural. And I tend to, especially with my crappie flies, I like to try and imitate what they're accustomed to eating a little bit more than the brightly colored stuff, although bright colored flies certainly have their place. So I would say a small bait fish imitation about 2 inches long would be a great place to start. And quite frankly, you can't go wrong with the classic woolly bugger. You know, it's probably one of the most popular flies out there today, and it catches just about everything that swims, including crappie. I catch a lot of crappie every spring, just throwing, bead-head woolly buggers. So I would say a small streamer would be a good place to start.
Yeah, I remember, again, when I was a kid, we fished with a lot of live minnows for crappie, So, yeah, it makes sense that they're more of a minnow feeder than bugs. Johnny Hill in North Carolina wrote in here on the internet. He's asking, is there any difference in flies' preference for fishing rivers versus ponds, or is it still anything goes?
That's a great question. And in my own experiences, and other folks may feel differently about this, but I think when we start talking about rivers and moving water, I think our panfish species, they start to behave more like fish that we're more familiar with, like trout. They get accustomed to seeing, in a still water environment, their food can move in every direction imaginable, up, down, sideways, diagonal. They have free motion to move around in the water column, and they often do. But in moving water, just like our trout and trout streams, the insect life is, most of it is incapable of swimming against the current, so it's at the mercy of the current. Paying a little bit more attention and getting some drag-free drifts and proper presentations, I think that becomes a little bit more important in moving water as it does in still water. And I tend to, my flies tend to be a little bit more natural in appearance, trying to mimic food items that are found in these moving bodies of water that the fish are accustomed to eating. But that being said, I will often, resort to, when everything fails, throw a bright yellow or chartreuse popper out there, and next thing you know, you're catching fish. So in moving water, I tend to go a little bit more with natural imitations, is, you know, instead of all the oddball stuff. And I try and be a little bit more particular with my presentations, being a little bit more cognizant of flows and making sure that the fly is behaving properly and not dragging upstream or moving unnaturally across the current.
You just mentioned chartreuse as a color. Are there other colors that you favor? And I'm not talking about the rivers, but in lakes.
Right, right, in general.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I think the colors, it's the colors of the rainbow. I don't know if any okay. one particular color is. I was told, though, and I have not been able to disprove this theory. I once had a conversation with an older gentleman at a boat ramp one time, and we were talking about flies, and I actually asked him that question, and he had a very curt response to me. He said, color does not matter as long as it's yellow. And he showed me his fly box, and
it's full of yellow, huh?
Yep, every single topwater fly he had was yellow.
yeah, and likewise, you know, you talk to most people that, that fish any kind of a streamer, and it's that that chartreuse and white streamer color, you know, that.
Yep, and that is a deadly color combination for crappie. It really is. Yeah. It's a great color combination.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, time to take another break, and when we come back, we'll be talking with Bart more about fly fishing for panfish. Fly Fishers International needs your support. Its conservation projects at both the national and club level are addressing critical issues of importance to fly fishers. The organization provides grants to help with the restoration of habitats like Wolf Creek in Idaho and Sands Creek in Delaware County, New York, and funds projects that collect valuable data about fish and their habitats, like the Peacock Bass Study in Miami, Florida. FFI serves as a strong advocate for fly fishing in all waters for all fish to preserve and to promote the arts of fly casting and fly tying, and to help ensure future generations can continue to enjoy these one-of-a-kind experiences. These efforts won't be nearly as effective without your help. If you're not already a member, we invite you to join Fly Fishers International as they work to cultivate conservation, education, and community within the sport of fly fishing. Join Fly Fishers International today and help support their fine work. For more information, go to their website at flyfishersinternational.org. Again, that's flyfishersinternational.org. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Bart Lombardo about passionately fishing for panfish. If you'd like to ask Bart a question, just go to our homepage, fill out that form, send it in, and we'll try to get it answered on the show tonight. Okay, Bart, let's talk about some strategies and tactics. But before that, Phil in Kentucky wrote in, and he said online, he says, as a youngster, keeping sunfish I caught was encouraged so that the remaining ones would have more to eat and grow larger. Later, I heard other management practices were in place to foster greater numbers of larger sunfish. What is the latest thinking about producing more large sunfish in the population?
That is a great question. And, you know, a lot of folks are under that, you know, that misconception that it's they're an inexhaustible resource. They are very prolific spawners. And, you know, if predator-prey ratios are off kilter, they could get, you know, quickly overpopulate a given body of water and create problems like stunted growth and interfering with, you know, other fish populations. But generally speaking, I think the most accepted practice nowadays is paying attention to the larger male bluegills. In the sunfish world, or excuse me, I say bluegills, but, you know, plug in sunfish there. Okay. In the sunfish world, it is the male fish that has a really important role to play. It's the male fish that seeks out and selects suitable spawning habit. It's the male fish that builds that nest. It's the male fish that attracts a female to the nest to lay the eggs. And it's the male fish that stays behind to guard those eggs until they hatch. And then they even stay on, you know, on point to guard the young until they're able to fend for themselves, or at least, you know, leave the nest and disperse into the rest of the water. So it's really important to protect those large males. The larger males, they're more successful breeders. They're more successful in driving off predators. You know, I've seen 8-inch bluegills drive off 6-7 pound largemouth bass that get a little bit too close to their nest. I've seen them do the same things to, to bottom feeders like catfish and carp that try and, feed on the young or the eggs in the nest. They will defend their nest sometimes to the death. So the larger the fish is, the more effective that they're going to be in protecting that nest and rearing those young. So by releasing larger bluegills, and by larger bluegills, I mean, those 8, 9, 10-inch fish, by putting those fish back, and if you want to take fish home for the table, you can, you can keep as many females as you like, and you can keep as many of the smaller males, say 7 inches and smaller. And that would, you're probably doing the most you could do for the population at that point. One of the, as you go around the country and you look at creel limits for these fish, many states don't even have one. I mean, you can keep as many as you want, and other states have very generous creel limits of, say, 25 or 50 fish per day. So anglers have the opportunity to keep quite a few of these fish, but if you're concerned about, number one, increasing the fishery or preserving the fishery that you have, protecting those large male fish, I think, is probably one of the most important things that you could do.
Yeah, good. Now, is there a fairly easy way to tell with sunfish the difference between males and females?
Yeah, it is pretty easy. The males generally are going to be much more brightly colored. Females will color a little bit up during the spawning season, but the males will they'll definitely color up significantly more than the females. And quite often, you can, if you've caught a couple fish, you can tell the difference right off the bat between the males and the females.
Okay.
Males will have slightly different body shapes too, but generally speaking, I think color is probably your best indicator, at least during the spawning season.
Okay.
Females will often be, go ahead.
Females, go
ahead.
I was
just saying, going to say that during the, during that spawning season when most anglers are out there fishing for these fish, the females won't be, they can sometimes be very obviously swollen with eggs, so it's easy to tell the difference between the two.
Yeah. William Henry from Brooklyn, New York wants to know, do you prefer lakes, ponds, or rivers?
All of the above. I probably do most of my fishing on smaller ponds, and for a number of reasons. Although recently I've really taken to exploring a lot of the lower ends of our trout streams during the summer months when it's too warm to fish for trout. I've been doing a lot of wet wading on some of these cool water, warm water creeks and exploring them. I've been really enjoying, fishing during the hottest days of summer in just a pair of shorts and a old pair of tennis shoes, wandering the banks of a warm water creek. But I think I do probably do most of my fishing on smaller bodies of still water, smaller ponds, smaller lakes. I really enjoy fishing out of, small personal watercraft, float tubes, kayaks, pontoon boats. And, I'll spend a lot of time chasing these fish in smaller bodies of water for a couple of reasons. They're usually easier to locate. You can become pretty familiar with all the features of a small pond in just a couple of outings and really get to know that water pretty intimately, and which it makes easy to find fish and, regardless of what time of the year that you're fishing. So I would say small ponds are probably my favorite.
Okay. William also asked about urban water versus rural water.
And that's another great thing about these fish. They are literally found anywhere. And that includes a lot of urban fisheries. These, typically when rivers are flowing through cities, they're not pristine trout streams. They're usually cool water or warm water rivers. And they abound with, various species of, sunfish, panfish, not just members of the sunfish family, but other fish species like white bass and yellow perch and white perch. There could be a ton of fish in these urban areas.
Yeah.
And they're stocked basically everywhere. Chances are that park pond in the middle of the city is probably stocked with a combination of some sort of bass and sunfish combination. They're often stocked in tandem.
I was going to say to William, since he's in Brooklyn, Last time I was in New York City visiting my daughter, she lived about six blocks from Central Park, and so we were walking over there, and I saw a couple of people fly fishing in one of the ponds there in Central Park. I didn't stick around to see if they caught anything or if they were just practicing their casting or not, but I'm guessing there's some kind of fish, probably some sunfish.
There most certainly is. Yeah. There most certainly is, and I have, in fact, fished Central Park myself. And
oh, have you? Okay,
the lakes and ponds out there have good populations of largemouth bass, bluegills, and, you know, a couple other sunfish species.
Yeah, isn't that great? Right in the middle of New York City. And go
fly fishing. And that's the great thing about these fish. That's why I, you know, promote these fish so much, because they are available to everybody regardless of where you live. You're going to find these fish close by.
Yeah. Can you talk about the most effective way to presenting your flies and also retrieval methods? I think in an article I read that you wrote, you were talking about, you know, different kinds of slower type retrieval methods.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, you know, one of the challenges, I think, when you get somebody that has spent their entire fly fishing experience on a moving trout stream, and then you bring them onto a, you know, a still water fishery where there's no current, everything is just, you know, people are, they're a little put off at first. It's like, you know, what do we do? How do we handle this situation? You know, do you retrieve the fly? How fast do you retrieve the fly? How slow do you retrieve the fly? Do you retrieve the fly at all? And of course, there's a lot of different fishing scenarios that will give you different answers to all these questions. But start out with a couple of the basics, and we'll start off with topwater flies. One of the things that I think are very important when you're fishing a topwater fly is to not move that fly for a significant period of time once it lands on the water. What often happens is, you know, a fly will land on the water, and occasionally fish will grab it right away. But more often or not, you know, sunfish are curious. They'll come up, they'll inspect the fly, they will kind of hover underneath it. And if you begin moving it right away, it'll often put fish down. What I like to do is, you know, cast that fly towards a appropriate piece of cover and let it sit motionless in the water for as long as I can bear, and then just twitch it slightly. And usually after that first twitch, the fly's going to disappear in a swirl. I'll move it a couple more times, and if I don't get a taker, I'll pick up and I'll present it to another location. There are times when fish will aggressively pursue a topwater fly that's moving quickly, but most of the time I take a more relaxed approach to that, and I try not to move the fly that much. And when moving the fly, I try that initial movement, I try and move it as little as possible. If you ever watched an insect struggling in the film of the water, they don't generally move aggressively across the surface. They usually, they're trapped in the surface film, and they kind of struggle in place. So I try and mimic that, at least with the first couple animations of the fly. And I do that by taking as much slack out of the line as I can without moving the fly. And then I'll just often just take my non-rod hand, the hand that's not holding the rod, and I'll just wrap the fly rod, and that will send vibrations down the fly line, and it'll actually move that fly in place without moving it a couple inches across the surface of the water. And I find that to be a very, very effective technique when fishing topwater flies, is to animate the fly in a way that you keep it in place and you don't move it too aggressively across the surface of the water. When fishing subsurface patterns, I rely a lot on a steady hand twist or figure eight retrieve. I like to kind of glide my flies through the water as opposed to stripping them. I think it helps the fish track the fly a little bit easier to make their final grab. When you're moving a fly erratically through the water, that may work well for a, you know, a larger ambush type predator like a largemouth bass that can, you know, doesn't have to be really precise with the way it takes a fly. But a smallmouth panfish, you know, they have to be a little bit more spot on to accurately grab a fly. So I find that slow, smooth, steady retrieves are a little bit more effective than stop-and-go stripping retrieves. So I rely a lot on a hand-twist retrieve, especially when fishing small streamers, and most importantly, when fishing those favorite soft tackles and wet flies.
Okay, okay. Let's talk, and we did have a question from Bill Latka in Omaha about tactics and flies for panfish throughout the year. And we've kind of touched on this before, but let's handle this. You know, we've talked a lot about the spring. What are your tactics for spring? What are your tactics for, you know, the hot days of summer? And then how do those change as we move into fall?
Sure. And again, spring is easy fishing. The fish are, they move into the shallows to spawn. They're generally found in, you know, shallow water. Of course, populations are going to be concentrated over good spawning habitat. Basically, you know, sand and gravelly areas are pretty popular places for these fish to nest. But in the spring, you're going to find them anywhere in the shallows, and they're going to be pretty abundant. What happens once the water warms up in the summer? For most of the United States, we get up, again, these fish range from Florida to Minnesota. So summers in Minnesota are a lot different from summers here in New Jersey or, you know, down in Georgia or Florida. So it's going to be region, there's going to be some regional aspects to this. But generally, as the water warms in the summer, the fish have a tendency to go deeper in areas where the shallows get too warm for the fish to be comfortable. You know, oxygen levels decrease and they're going to seek out cooler, more oxygenated water. So in the summer months, I do tend to fish a little bit deeper. I fish more mid-lake structure as opposed to shoreline structure, and I'll break out those intermediate and sinking lines. But there's also some shallow water opportunities, especially at first light when the water is generally at its coolest, and also at dusk when the sun gets off the water and those fish are active to, you know, they're anxious to start feeding again. A lot of their food still resides in the shallows, and they utilize those shallows early in the day, late in the day, and, you know, sometimes during periods of extended overcast, they'll get into that shallow water to feed. So during the summer, I tend to fish a little bit deeper. I tend to fish, you know, offshore weed beds and or any shoreline structure that's adjacent to deeper water, like a fallen tree that's next to a drop-off or, you know, something of that nature. As we get into the fall could bring just a whole bunch of different fishing conditions. As the water cools, those fish will leave their deep water haunts that they spent the summer in, and they'll once again occupy the shallow water. But the problem with the fall is as the season progresses, we get a lot of changing weather, we get cooler temperatures, so those fish tend to move in and out of the shallows based on weather conditions until the water cools down to the point where they start to adopt a more winter pattern where they tend to school up and seek out the most stable water they can, which usually means, you know, some of the deeper sections of the ponds and lakes that they live in. But the fall could provide some excellent fishing. The fish seem to sense that time is running out and they got to put on the calories before the water gets too cold. So, you know, warm periods of stable weather in the fall and those Indian summer days, they could provide almost spring-like type fishing for panfish. The fishing could be very good. As we get into the winter months, the fish tend to school up. They tend to school up by year class. So if you catch one big fish, there's likely to be others around. If you catch a small fish, there's likely to be, you know, other smaller fish around. But sunfish in particular, they feed year-round. You can, you know, all the anglers that are out there fishing through the ice at this time of year through the winter, they catch more than their share of crappies and bluegills and other species of sunfish, yellow perch. These fish feed actively throughout the winter months, but like all fish, as their metabolism slows, their bodies slow down. They don't feed as aggressively as they do in warmer temperatures, and they don't need to feed as much because that lower body metabolism doesn't require as many calories to keep the machine running. But they can be caught during periods of cold weather, but you really do have to modify your tactics. You got to keep that fly in front of their face for as long as you can, which means you got to fish painfully slow. One of my favorite tactics for cold water fishing during the winter months is, you know, fishing those small soft tackles and wet flies that I mentioned, or fishing midge larva and pupa underneath an indicator. That is often very effective. But the important thing fishing during that those winter months is to, you know, pick the right time of the right weather conditions and, you know, the right time of day to go out and fish. I try and fish during the warmest part of the day, so that's usually, you know, mid-afternoon. And I look for a period of bright, sunny weather that's going to start warming the shallow, dark bottom flats. That's where I try and focus most of my winter fishing in. These fish will move up out of the deeper water and they'll push into these flats if they warm up a couple degrees searching for food. Obviously, the water has to be ice-free to do this. So I usually will start a couple weeks after ice out. I'll wait for, you know, some unseasonably warm weather, a string of two or three bright sunny days with calm winds. And those dark bottom flats, those shallow dark bottom flats, they'll heat up pretty quickly and sunfish will begin to move into those areas. They'll move out once conditions change, and they may only move in for an hour or two during the day when the water's at its warmest. But, you know, very slowly retrieving a pair of small soft tackles could be deadly for those late winter panfish.
Ralph in New Hampshire wants to know about fishing for panfish during the colder months from shore. Can you be effective, or do you need to get out on the water?
You can. If you're targeting, what I like to do is, if you're going to fish during the winter months, is find the smallest body of water that you can. Those smaller bodies of water are going to heat up a lot quicker than, you know, larger natural or man-made lakes. So the first thing I look for is a small body of water. The next thing I look for is shallow water, meaning that the deepest part of the lake is still relatively shallow. A lot of smaller farm ponds that I fish, the deepest part of that pond may only be 6 feet deep. And with the right equipment, it is perfectly reachable with a fly rod if you're fishing the right lines, the right leaders, the right flies. And when trying to locate panfish during those cold winter months when they're congregated, they're schooling up, and usually in deeper water, well, if the deepest water in the pond is 6 feet deep and you can reach it with a fly rod, you have a good chance of finding these concentrations of fish. And one of the areas that I'll concentrate my efforts on, if you know that pond has a man-made dam, at the water, the deepest water of that pond is typically going to be relatively close to that dam face. And you know, if it's an earthen dam that you can get up on top of and, you know, fish the water in front of it, you often just by fan casting and, you know, covering every inch of water, you can find these fish. And if you find one, there's usually others in the vicinity. And then again, there's always those dark bottom flats that I spend a lot of time on as well. That may require the use of a watercraft, though.
I got two more questions I want to get through, even though we're over time here. But let me read this one from Steve Schramm. It's in California. It's a rather long one, but he says, I fly fish two small ponds in the Bay Area foothills of California in early April that contain black crappie. Water is pretty clear in both ponds, and when the surface temperature reaches 62 degrees, the crappie will start to approach and take dry flies on the surface. As long as they are not moved and as they rise up to take them. If the dry is moved or twitched, the slowly rising crappie will turn off. At 64 to 66 degrees, the crappie will become more aggressive and will readily take dries that are twitched on the surface as they approach to take them. By the time surface water temperatures reach 68, the crappie seemingly disappear from the lake and will no longer rise to a dry, and I cannot catch them on the subsurface nymphs, such as pheasant tails either. You'd swear there are no crappie in the ponds at this point. Any idea on how to target these later season crappie when surface temperatures are 68 degrees and up?
So what Steve is describing is exactly what happens everywhere. His lake is no different than my lakes here on the East Coast. And what he's observing directly relates to the conversation we just had on water temperature and fish metabolism. It all makes perfect sense. When that water is cooler, the fish are not going to act as aggressively. They're not going to pursue food as aggressively. So that still floating dry fly is going to be more attractive to them than a meal that they have to chase down. So cooler temperatures, it totally makes sense that those fish are more attracted to a still topwater fly as opposed to a moving one. That 64 to 66 degree temperature, again, for crappie, that's prime time. They're going to be the most active at that point, and they will readily take flies on the surface, below the surface. Once the water temps get a little bit warmer, they tend to seek out that cooler temperature range, so they're going to move a little bit towards deeper water and deeper structure. And it may also take them out of the shallows. The fish are in the shallows in the spring when that water is in the high 50s, low 60s for their spawning. And then when the water temperature moves up, they go post-spawn, and they tend to orient around a deeper structure. Now, he did mention that he's not catching them on subsurface nymphs such as pheasant tails. He may want to change over to a fly that I described in an earlier question, that smaller streamer, you know, a streamer, or even large wet flies. I catch a lot of crappie in the spring on big wet flies. So fishing a wet fly or a streamer and targeting some deeper structure. Another tactic that I use, especially during the summer months, is I will suspend balance flies, balance leeches, balance bait fish imitations underneath either a strike indicator or more typically a topwater popper or foam bug, and I'll drop that balance streamer, that balanced leech, a couple feet below that topwater fly. And as I animate that topwater fly, I'm also animating that balanced fly that maintains that horizontal position in the water that, you know, most bait fish do. They don't swim perpendicular. You know, they swim straight up and down like everybody else. So the balanced flies imitate that very well. So fishing a balanced leech or a balanced late bait fish under a popper, along weed edges and fallen trees, I think you'll find that you'll start picking up those fish that seem to disappear. They haven't, they've disappeared. They've disappeared from the shallows. They haven't disappeared from the lake. They're still there.
Right.
They've just moved up to deeper structure.
Okay, one more question from Phil in Kentucky. Are large sunfish extremely rare, or do folks not understand that fishing for them requires changing the way they typically fish for sunfish? The large sunfish I have caught have usually been taken when I was fishing for bass and throwing flies I would have guessed would have been too large for sunfish. We talked about this earlier. Apart from using relatively large flies, what should I do to increase my chances of catching large sunfish? What can I do to find water holding sunfish that are large, 10 inches or more?
Yeah, big sunfish are a challenge because I think these are some of the hardest freshwater trophies out there. If you think about all the sports bars and tackle shops and fly shops that you've been in and you see these 50-inch musky, 30-inch brown trout, 10-pound bass hanging on the walls, how many 12-inch bluegills have you seen up on these walls?
Not many.
Yeah. And it's not because the fish don't exist. It's because I think, and a lot of people may call me to task on this, but I think catching a 2.5, 3-pound bluegill is harder than catching a 30-inch brown trout. These fish, once they reach, to get to that size, they got to be doing something different than the rank and file. And they're definitely a lot more wary, a lot more selective than their smaller brothers and sisters. So there is definitely a challenge aspect to this where they are a little bit more challenging to catch outside of that spawning period, of course. During that spawning period, that's when a lot of these big sunfish are caught because they are so easily taken at that point because they so aggressively defend those nests. Anything dropped in it usually is picked up. But once you get outside of that spawning period, I think these fish offer some of the most challenging fly fishing in North America. They really are difficult to catch. They are not common by any means because they are a prey species. Most of the fish get eaten before they get to any size, any appreciable size like that. But those bigger fish, they do occupy different water. They tend to run a little bit deeper. They tend to spawn a little bit deeper than the smaller fish. So I think just changing the depth in which you fish and try and target deeper fish-holding structure, you may find those larger fish. As far as identifying a body of water that holds these bigger fish, I think, you know, over the years I've kind of identified a couple trends where, you know, you can kind of very quickly determine whether or not a lake contains sizable sunfish. The presence of stunted fish is one thing that certainly is you should move on and find another body of water. As I mentioned earlier, if predator-prey ratios are off, these fish could quickly overpopulate and stunt their own populations. So if you're finding a lot of really small fish, a lot of my local lakes have that problem where a lot of the bass have been removed from the lakes and sunfish just take over the place. If you have a good bass lake that produces a lot of good-sized bass, chances are that is also an excellent big sunfish lake as well. So find good bass water, you'll find good sunfish water.
All right. Great way to wind the night up. Bart, unfortunately, it's time to quit. It was time to quit 10 minutes ago, but we had too much good stuff to talk about here. So good questions coming in. But we got to wrap it up now, and we're going to stick with me here because we're going to give away a few things, and we're going to give away a one-year membership to Fly Fishers International and a one-year membership to Trout Unlimited. And we're going to give away a selection of your favorite panfish flies, courtesy of Panfish on the Fly. So check out Bart's site, panfishonthefly.com, and give him some support out there. Just a quick reminder to everyone before you leave the website tonight, please take a minute and give us some feedback about the show. You can find the link on our homepage in the section under tonight's show that says, what did you think of the show? Just click on that link and leave your comments. We'd really appreciate it. Now it's time to give away our prizes. The winners of our drawings are randomly selected from the show's registration database. And if you didn't register for tonight's show, it's too late now, but make sure you do so for our next show because you don't want to miss out on a chance to win some of these great prizes we have to offer. Now, if you are one of the lucky winners, we'll contact you after the show to collect the information so we can deliver your prize to you. First, we'll give away a one-year membership to Fly Fishers International. And to learn more about FFI, go to flyfishersinternational.org. It's a great organization support, so if you don't win, go out and join anyway. Our winner for that is Jim Wright in California. Jim Wright. So congratulations, Jim, on your membership. I know you'll enjoy it. Now we're going to give away a one-year membership to Trout Unlimited. To learn more about Trout Unlimited, go to tu.org, and check them out. Another great organization to support. And again, you don't win, go join. Our winner for that is Bill Latka in Nebraska. Bill Latka in Nebraska. So congratulations, Bill, on winning that. And I know both you gentlemen will enjoy your memberships. Now for tonight's question and to win the selection of Bardo's panfish flies. The question is, and the way you do this is you answer it on that form on our homepage where you've been asking questions during the show. So that's where you're going to answer this question. It's actually a two-part question. There were two hook sizes that Bart favored for his flies, for panfish. And so that's one part of the two-part question. The other part is, what was the name of the fly that Bart invented for panfish? So two-part question. You got to get them both right to win. First person gets it correct will win the selection of panfish flies from Bart Lombardo and Panfish on the Fly. So, Bart, we've got a little delay here from them hearing me and then them responding. So we're going to give it a few seconds here as I refresh and look for the answers coming in. And we'll see if we can get a winner here for you. And so what are the names of some of these flies that you're going to include in your selection?
Well, there'll certainly be a couple triangle bugs in there, but I'll include a selection of flies top to bottom. Some of my favorite wet flies, nymph patterns, topwater bugs, and a few streamers as well. So we'll cover the whole gamut there.
Well, it looks like our first one in says triangle fly and size 6 and 4. That wasn't what I was looking for. Oh, one of those was off, Phil McCartney. One of those was off. Next one coming up is Mike Sousa, 8 and 14 in a triophy. No, Michael, that's not what I was looking for. And let's see, we got Luther Kyle, Memphis. He says 6, 8 in a triangle. Is that sound right to you?
That's close enough. Yeah, size 6 yep. and 8 is definitely my size preference, and the name of the fly yep. is the triangle bug.
Triangle bug, yeah. Okay, all right. Yeah. So, Luther, what you do is fill in, and you can use the same text box you just answered in. Send us your address. I've got your email address here. Yeah, I got your email address and your name. Just send us your address, and then I will connect you with Bart, and he will get you those flies. He did say it's probably going to be after the holidays before he gets those out to you, but that'll give you some time to think about where you're going to fish them. So, so anyway, yeah, congratulations, Luther. Thanks for paying attention, and thanks for everybody for listening tonight. Oh, hold on. Had a big sneeze there, folks. Sorry about that. Bart, really appreciate you being on and staying up late for us on the East Coast there and sharing all your knowledge. It was just a pleasure to talk with you, and thanks for sharing your experience and knowledge with us.
Same here, Roger. Thank you for having me on the show. Thoroughly enjoyed it.
So, everybody, hopefully you found the podcast archive on our website. If you haven't, just look for the link on the top line menu. In the archive, you'll find all of our past shows, over 400 and some shows now, and you can search by keyword phrase to find what you're looking for. And I'm sure you'll find lots of things that'll make you happy out there. Next broadcast will be on January 8th, 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. And on that show, I'll interview Landon Mayer. And our show is going to be Tying Guide Flies and Other Favorites. Colorado professional guide Landon Mayer is well known in the Rockies for putting his clients on incredible trophy trout. Landon shares tying steps and fishing and rigging tips for several of his signature guide flies for trout and bass. These nymphs, dry flies, and streamers have proven to be effective around the world. Join us and get the lowdown on why these flies work and how you can use them to catch more fish. To do this, just add it to your calendar. Right below Landon's picture, you'll find a link. Click on that link, add it to your calendar, then you'll be all set for the next live show. We'd like to thank Fly Fishers International, Trout Unlimited, Bonefish and Tarpon Trust, Olympic Peninsula Skagit Tactics, and the Ugly Bug Fly Shop, and Watermaster for sponsoring our show tonight. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.